Welcome to Breaking Free Podcast, your recovery, your way. I'm Tiffany.
And I'm Liv. You're in the right place if you want to explore what it means to be in recovery, to challenge the things that keep us small, and to learn how to thrive independently.
Together we are breaking free. Just a quick reminder that while I'm a nurse and a coach, and Liv is a coach, recovery advocate, and a writer, we are not doctors. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you need to, please, please see a doctor.
The Alana Club of Portland is proud to sponsor the Breaking Free podcast. Your recovery, your way, is at the heart of our approach to recovery support services.
Unity Recovery, an inclusive recovery community organization serving all of Philadelphia, is proud to support the Breaking Free podcast. Recovery is possible. Find your path to break free.
All right. Well, welcome, everyone. We're so excited to have you on today. We're going to be talking with our wonderful guest, Lynn Maddie. She is our friend and the host of Sober Soul.
I have recovery. To
make sure I said Sober Soul Recovery. And so she has a podcast as well. We love her podcast, and we wanted to have her on today. We're going to be talking about trauma, but first we want to hear a little bit more about Lynn and tell you how much we love her. So I met Lynn last year at She Recovers and in L.A., and just immediately loved her warm energy and her curiosity and her intellect. And so we just hit it off immediately. And then she has really been a big help for us in terms of getting this podcast up and going, and really been somebody who's cheered us on. So we really appreciate her for so many reasons. Liv, how did you meet Lynn?
She Recovers too. We'd connected online before. And then Veronica Valley, who was at She Recovers too, just said, you have to meet Lynn. And then equally, we hit it off. And then I feel like Lynn was the equivalent of Veronica in New York. You know, I struck up a friendship with Veronica and with Jen McNeely in New York. And then we've been fast friends ever since. And the same with Lynn.
So, Miss Lynn, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started in this work and why you're passionate about it.
Well, first of all, I love you guys. Thank you. It's so nice to be, you know, with other women that I respect and supporting each other. So there you have that. So I'm a counselor by training. I came late to the field of counseling via my own recovery. Mm. I'm in recovery from a boatload of things, including alcohol, benzodiazepines, trauma, codependency, enmeshed families, you know, a lot. and so my journey was long. I think, like a lot of us, I started my process of trying to be sober long before I actually got sober in 2010. After me, I needed to go to residential treatment. I just needed that intensity. And after that, I spent 2 years really focusing on learning how to be different. Completely new person in life. And after that, I went to Hazel and Betty Ford Graduate School and became a counselor. And my passion has really emerged, my purpose, I think, in life, out of that initial thrust of kind of learning something new. And I went to work for Hazel and Betty Ford and then got some more experience and became a licensed professional clinical counselor in Minnesota, and then moved to Georgia, Peachtree City, Georgia. And this is where I opened up my private practice for counseling and then started Sober Soul Recovery, because I had learned about online recovery back at Hazel and Betty Ford. I had clients talking to me about this really cool podcast called The Bubble Hour. And I'm like, what's that about? And I'd already known about She Recovers, but didn't really understand it. I mean, I've liked their page probably for as long as I've been sober, going back, you know, to like 2012, I think 13. I'm not sure when they came online, but I didn't really understand online recovery and what it was all about. So when I moved down here, I just started learning about it.
Yeah. I want to ring a couple of bells, like one just for how much you have accomplished and how your recovery really brought you to this helping arena, and you've helped so many people. So yay for that. And then a bell for She Recovers, since it brought us all together, and a bell for Bubble Hour, since it obviously inspired us all a little bit in the podcasting arena.
Yeah.
Thanks, and
Jean McCarthy. Yeah. I mean, it was wonderful. I got to meet her at She Recovers LA very briefly at the last day. It was really calm and wonderful to sit and chat with her. It's just an incredible environment, curious environment for me, kind of transferring my in-person stuff that I've learned to online. But that was kind of long, but there you go. That's me.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to dive into the topic at hand. Let's see, Liv, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Let's talk about how prevalent trauma history is with those who have substance use disorder. What's your experience there?
Well, my experience is that they're intermingled in most clients that I've worked with. And I think the research states anywhere from, you know, like 40% of people presenting, adults presenting to substance use treatment, all the way up to 90%, have some kind of co-occurring disorder. So not necessarily trauma, but anxiety or depression, which often is the symptom of trauma, what we used to call little T or big T trauma. And now what has become broadly known as ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, and childhood emotional neglect. Mm. So I think it's from my own experience, almost everybody who comes to some type of substance use disorder has a mix of some kind of trauma.
And also, you know, the experience of substance use disorder itself is traumatic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not for everybody. One of the great aspects of this whole sober curious discussion is that people are coming to the idea that they can live without coping with a substance much earlier. But, you know, I think what happened to me and a lot of other people is that discussion was not available to us, and we just kept on doing what we were doing, coping the way we were coping, and inevitably you're going to have some traumatic experience out of that. And I certainly fit the bill for that, you know.
Stuff
I had to talk about with a counselor.
Well, let's talk. You mentioned the ACE study, and then you also mentioned childhood emotional neglect. And so let's talk about that ACE study and what were some of the most profound insights that you found from the study?
The most profound impact, I had one of those moments where I can tell you, I was on the way to the gas station on a Saturday getting my car washed and getting gassed up for the week when I was working at Hazel and Betty Ford in Minneapolis. And I was listening to NPR and they had the ACE study on. Now, this was 2015. I started grad school in 2012, had never heard of the ACE study, which was done back in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. So I was floored that this was, first of all, I'm like, why am I just hearing about this incredibly profound study? And then I literally sat on the side of the road near my house for almost a half an hour listening to this thing. And then I went home and looked it up on NPR, and I was overwhelmed with the amount of information that that I had not gotten in my own education. So first, the profound thing was that I had not heard about it in my counseling education or my practice. And then just the breadth of knowledge that, you know, these issues around adverse childhood experiences, which, you know, are abuse, neglect, and what's the third category? Household dysfunction. That those are the three areas that the ACE study covers. So it's not just about what we call these big T traumas, you know, the sexual abuse, the physical abuse, or the incredibly harsh verbal abuse. It was all-encompassing. In my case, for instance, I had a parent who had a mental illness, and it wasn't just anxiety or depression. It was bipolar, bipolar one, and that is one of the ACE criteria, or it's called something else, but you know what I mean. One of the questions for the ACE study.
Yeah. And what were the three things again?
Abuse, neglect, and household dysfunction. And just for y'all out there, I have a screen up that tells me this. I'm not great with memorizing everything. But under abuse, there's physical, emotional, and sexual. Under neglect, it's physical and emotional. So that childhood emotional neglect. And then household dysfunction is mental illness, incarceration, which goes to your extended family, not just your immediate, your parents, your nuclear family. Mother or sibling or father treated with violence, substance abuse, and of course, divorce. Yeah. That's trauma.
Mm-hmm. I have the study right in front of me in the book, Childhood Disrupted. I do. And I think when we talk about trauma, this was my experience. When I started therapy, I'd kind of tinkered around with therapy in the UK, but it's, you know, NHS therapy in comparison to therapy in the States that you pay for is considerably different. And when I had thought of trauma, I was thinking huge things like domestic abuse or PTSD, you know, things like that. And I hadn't thought, and even the neglect that we talk about, you know, I was thinking about kids that were just left and with
like
a parent.
Dirty spaces or
something. Exactly. Yeah. And then actually when my therapist took me through it, I was pretty surprised that actually it's not as severe. It can be that severe, but it's not necessarily that severe. So, you know, for example, question one, did a parent or another adult in the house swear at you, insult you, put you down or humiliate you? Or act in a way that made you feel afraid or that you might be physically hurt. That's, you know, there's such a broad spectrum there. Humiliation is huge, a huge aspect of the study.
Yeah.
But actually, when you think about each question, and I'm not going to read everyone, we can put in the show notes those things. And, you know, and like divorce is really common. Mm-hmm. You know, my experience was that I left the US at 3 years old and grew up without my father. That was pretty huge. I was pretty horrified at my, it was huge. Yeah. My score is pretty high.
Yeah.
But it was profound for me. Anyway.
And so informative. I think modern psychotherapy, and by modern, I'm talking about like 1995 to present, is so different than what people are still using as a visual explanation in their heads about what therapy is like. Informed around trauma has a much broader base than the term allows. Like if you Google, what does trauma-informed mean? And I think, Tiffany, you and I spoke about this briefly one day in the past. And it really is more about understanding what we are not learning generationally. And the beauty of the age that we live in is that there is so much information available to us that we're talking about it more, you know? And if we launch kind of on that idea and spread the knowledge just by our own experiences of the fact that it's really scary to live in a different country than one of your parents, you feel a lack of attachment because of that. And that attachment is one of those things, the criteria that we use to understand how you cope with things in life. And that language comes up through studies like the ACE study and understanding what childhood emotional neglect really means to you, Tiffany, to you, Liv, or to any of you out there listening. Like, it doesn't matter what's in a book. It's the discussion about what happened to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, that I need to look more into it, but I stumbled the other day on, the ACE study and in this article, along with a resilience scoring.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, the other side of, you know, there's more to it than just, whether you experienced trauma or not. And like Liv was saying, you know, it's very nuanced, right? Whether something, how did this have an impact on you? And then like you're saying, Lynn, how did you kind of go about life from that experience? And then of course, you know, the story that we have around it and how important that is. You know, two people can be in a 7-Eleven that's being held up or something and have very different responses to that experience. So the resilience piece, I was like, ooh, I want to get more into that. I have no idea if it's based in science. I just stumbled upon it the other day and haven't.
It's absolutely based in science. Yeah. And it's part of any kind of training that you go through as a counselor. It's strength-based. Every kind of assessment, if you will. I don't do formal assessments because I don't really love the idea of diagnosing people, but I do use the information from the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual.
It's a really big book.
It's a really big book. I have mine somewhere. Because it has a
your
lot
computer,
of...
isn't it?
Yeah, it's...
I have the essentials of sport and exercise nutrition holding up mine.
Yeah, I mean, you can see I've had this for a while and has study tabs in it and everything else. Yeah. But predominantly, I use it for information and, you know, looking at when you are thinking of going to see a counselor or a coach or having, needing some help. If we could get the message out that the idea of helping people includes understanding your strengths, your aptitude for resilience, wow, I think a lot of people would come to counseling who are not coming or going to a coach who are even afraid to go to, you know, a recovery coach or a life coach or a nutrition coach, because understanding your strength is how we determine what has worked for you. Mm-hmm. That's resilience. And we all have it.
Yeah. Yeah. And for me, in the nurse coaching program that I did, we definitely talk about, you know, strength-based coaching. However, there isn't necessarily that connection made between, you know, trauma-informed care, childhood experiences, you know, other types of trauma, and then resilience, right? There's not necessarily that connection made in the training. And so even as a nurse, even as someone who's been through trauma-informed, care training, like formal training at the hospital, and someone who's been through strength-based coach training, that those connections still aren't being made. And so that's something, you know, you talked about this, that, you know, throughout your training, it wasn't until toward the end that you even discovered the ACE study.
Right.
And so it's really interesting. I think that it's really important to recognize that this is something that's just now being really applied in clinical settings, and it's not being applied as thoroughly as it could be. And so it's important for people to know that and be able to advocate for themselves and recognize that, you know, this healthcare system that we have and the recovery world as well isn't necessarily set up ideally to support someone who's trying to work through these things.
Yeah. Completely agree. I think the problem there, you know, if I look at it from my training and my work in institutions, from that vantage point, the problem is, and with doctors, and for instance, I've worked with a lot of physicians, you know, primary care physicians who have zero knowledge about addiction. Mm-hmm. And it's frustrating, right? However, when you look at the breadth of knowledge that anyone in the healthcare profession or the mental wellness profession has to actually take in,
it's a lot.
It's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, you have to keep up on all these things. You know, that's the continuing education part, and it can get really overwhelming. I think that's what caused me to specialize, even though I can treat all kinds of mental health issues. I do. I specialize in substance use and what I call self-esteem therapy, because I think for me, that's where my passion lies, in building people up from the self-esteem baby, as I call it, that they have inside of them. Wow. Men can have a self-esteem baby too.
let's have a bell for that. And then we need to take a little break. We're going to take a, have a bell for the self-esteem baby. and then let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. And then, we want to dive more into how you treat and what your clinical experience is around trauma. So here we go.
The Alana Club of Portland is proud to sponsor the Breaking Free podcast. Your recovery, your way, is at the heart of our approach to recovery support services. As the largest and most diversely programmed non-clinical recovery support center in the United States, we've been proudly breaking barriers and forging new pathways for years to ensure everyone has a home in recovery. From peer mentoring to recovery CrossFit, from trauma-informed yoga to mindfulness training, the Alana Club of Portland has a recovery pathway that's right for you. Here at Unity Recovery, we believe recovery should be the expectation, not the exception. Whether you find support with mutual aid, harm reduction, medication, or yoga, your recovery is beautiful and worth celebrating. Learn more and become part of the recovery movement at unityrecovery.org.
And we're back. All right. And so tell us a little bit about how the insights that you got from the ACE study and from, you know, your experience seeing how there is a lack of support around, you know, people with addiction or with who struggle with substance use disorder and trauma. How has that influenced how you treat your clients?
Well, before I found out about the study, I was informed, if you will, and again, that word is kind of getting misused. Trauma-informed simply means, like, if you have a class or even full training within an institution, it just gives you some skills to identify. Well, first, it gives you background of what trauma is, and that can include childhood emotional neglect, but it doesn't often include that piece of it. It includes more of the PTSD trauma work and some of the complex childhood trauma. But the informed or information piece, what is most actionable out of that is learning then how to recognize that in a client or a patient, and then what to do with that information. And that's the piece that gets lost and muddied in using the term trauma-informed. Mm. We, I think, need more training out there in the ether world about how to then proactively treat the trauma. And to that end, when I took back, I immediately, when I heard about this ACE study, I that next Monday morning in my staffing meeting, I was like, hey, have you all heard about this? Mm-hmm. You know, can we just talk about the ACE study? And nobody was really all that interested. We had other really important things to talk about, like clients. Mm. But I started incorporating in my group therapy, especially questions about how did you learn how to perceive the world in this way? Mm. And, you know, those actionable steps I'm talking about, referring back to the trauma informed, like how then do we talk to people about making movement and getting proper treatment, care, interaction around trauma. So how that worked for me when I was working with group therapy was to ask questions around other things that we are already talking about, like your triggers, what causes you anxiety, where does the anxiety come from, what kind of coping skills, or how did you learn to cope with problems in your life? And the hard knock is that most of us don't get training in coping. We just kind of are left out there to figure out what the hell we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. we either don't talk about that, or we only talk about it in such a way that we get over it. And that's one of my big things. We don't get over anything. It stays with us. We learn how to cope with it. Mm-hmm. We don't get over things. We get through them. And so coming back to like how I work with people around the issues of what is discovered if I walk them through the ACE study, or we're just talking about how they learned to be in this world and cope with things that were difficult. We talk about values. We talk about the belief systems that they grew up within. And out of that comes the knowledge of how people cope. Like, some people just believe in a God and God's going to take care of everything. And those people come to see a counselor and they're baffled when trauma raises up in them. You know, it can be just people who are taught to love God speaking really badly to them. It can also be sexual and other kinds of abuse. But let's just say you had a parent who was a big believer in God, godly man or woman, and on the side talked to you really badly, you know, and sometimes screamed at you and sometimes invoked God because of that. That's a traumatic experience. It is housed in not understanding what's coming in and being taught to you around God, and then what this God-fearing person is doing to you. And then you never talk about it. So this person ends up in my office, and I'm like, well, how did you learn how to understand God? And how did you learn to understand when people treated you poorly? And what could you do about it? You know, and there's lots to talk about around that particular issue, but that's just one example from a recent client in real life, that people need help around making sense of things, you know, and especially around trauma that they don't actually recognize as trauma. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
I love that. And I guess, go on.
Oh, I love
no, I
that
was just
you...
gonna. You go.
Okay.
There you go.
Well, I love that you brought the idea forward that in discovering and exploring more about the traumatic experiences, you're also able to tease out or discover where the strength and the resilience comes from, and how we have coped with that, and then, you know, to find a way through, like you said, based on those strengths and based on, you know, coping skills. So, yeah. Liv, what about you? What were you going to say?
I was going to say, you know, those insights have been so helpful in my recovery, because they, you know, like you were saying, the building of the self-esteem, but the learning coping strategies through therapy, you know, that's been the most profound tools that I've been given through that process. Because I didn't, like you say, you know, you don't necessarily know those coping skills, and I didn't. And I think going back to the ACE study, what I found so interesting about it, aside from the fact that physicians don't know about it, is that it can actually determine statistically how likely you are to develop substance use disorder or chronic illness or autoimmune conditions in later life. So a man who has a score of, what is it, 6 or more, is 46-fold more likely to become an IV heroin user in later life. Yeah. I mean, that is profound to me. I just was blown away, but I just don't understand why physicians don't know about it. You know, I went to see a rheumatologist recently and she didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
And yet, physicians like Gabor Maté, I mean, he's written books on this.
But he's viewed as an outlier, frankly, in the field that he's in. I mean, he's respected by a lot of people, including me, but you know, when physicians, you know, I've talked to physicians, my own physicians, about this and asked them, you know, what's the challenge in learning these new things? And again, this kind of fits into how I am in recovery, just trying to find compassion for whoever I'm mad at sometimes, you know, like, why the hell don't you know this?
Yeah.
And they have a sequence, you know, there's so much information that a physician has to learn that they learn this way of working with clients, just like coaches and counselors do, that you're supposed to go through 1, 2, 3, 4, and then put on top of that the fact that they have to then feed all that same information to an insurance company, because we're using insurance, that they don't have a lot of room, wiggle room, to ask more profound questions. But we're getting there. I mean, there are a lot of people out in the world of medicine and mental health doing that work, changing gradually the DSM to include, which is what happened in the last DSM revision, to separate out PTSD, for instance, into, I closed my book. What's the actual title? Trauma and stress related disorders instead of an anxiety disorder, because people were treating it with things like benzodiazepines, which are highly addictive, by the way.
Yeah.
I know for Swizzle. Yeah. And so you have trauma, you go to see a doctor and they're treating it as an anxiety problem. Whereas now it's treated as a trauma problem.
Yeah.
So gradually the information shift is coming from these big organizations down, and that's the hardest shift to make. So we have to get out there and talk more on the ground level to get people encouraged to do that.
And thank you for the work you're doing to increase that.
Yeah, but I'm just one person. We got to get out there.
Yeah, we're doing it. We're doing it.
Yeah, conversations are huge.
Exactly.
So let's talk about, you know, the fact that not everybody has access to therapy.
Totes.
Yeah, it is unfortunate that it is something that privilege is involved in.
Totally.
You know, to be able to access that, unfortunately, like medical care. And so let's say you're a person who only has a mutual aid program available. Mm-hmm. Given the complexity of substance use disorder and co-occurring issues like trauma that we've been talking about, what challenges might someone face going into a mutual aid program if they have a trauma background?
Well, it can vary. The most significant problem, and I have a dog who wants to get up on my chair, so bear with me. Hold on. She's going to keep at it.
Aww.
Come on. Come on, baby. Come
up here. No, she
doesn't want to. I wish
mine was a
lot.
She's sassy. That's her name. sorry, guys. All right. So the difficulty with mutual aid groups is that they're run by humans. This is what I tell everybody if they have any kind of issue. And the fact is that mutual aid groups are coming of age and getting like on that, they're senior citizens in the idea of what we were just talking about, this, how the medical community and the mental health community is changing their perspective on trauma. We know that most people are not learning how to cope with what we call the difficult emotions. And those people then have these adverse childhood experiences, and they maybe get a substance use disorder, and then the first line of defense is always sending them to a 12-step group. And why I love your podcast and your advocacy, both of you, for challenging the notion that that has to be your first line of defense is that when you go to these meetings, it's highly individual on who's running the meeting as to what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And you know, I tell this story all the time, but I got sober in central Wisconsin, Wausau, Wisconsin, for those of you who might be listening. And there were, at the time, in 2010, 23 meetings in the town. And I didn't find my meeting until I went through all of them. Wow. And it was, for me, probably not the kind of meeting that a lot of people would love. I like being challenged personally, and that's why a lot of people shied, told me not to go to this meeting. But in the other meetings, because of my trauma history, when somebody would like put their hand on me and say, that's not how we do it, or quite like the old timers. I remember one time I think I was 6 months sober and I just went, you know, I'm like, yay, I'm 6 months sober. How did you do it? They asked. And I told them everything I was doing, you know, and this guy leans over and says, all you have to do is say, I do it one day at a time. And I'm like, I didn't like that at all. I didn't like him touching me. I didn't like those kind of responses because they reminded me of my trauma. So I think understanding that you may have to change seats if you go to a meeting, or if you don't want to go to a meeting at all, that finding other opportunities to be around people who actually know what they're doing in recovery, not just other people who maybe you have a buddy. This just happened with me with a client who he found somebody who just got out of their third detox. And now he said that we're going to be sponsors to each other. You know, and I'm like, well, that's probably not optimal. I mean, you can do that, but to really negotiate the traumatic experience with getting help, I guess that's how I'd reframe that kind of question, like in 12-step meetings, is to understand your triggers to your trauma. So if you don't like people touching you, then you may not want to go to a meeting where you're encouraged to like hang on to people's hands and say the Lord's Prayer, whatever it is, or the Serenity Prayer, and knowing that that's okay. And for some people, that's going to take listening to a podcast first or talking to somebody who maybe who has been through therapy. But I think proactively, we as a community can reframe things, restructure the way we talk about even groups that we may not think are healthy. Like, I went to a lot of meetings that I would not send anybody to. But then to discourage the idea of 12 steps, like, I know that's not what you guys are about at all, but breaking free of the notion that that's the only way forward for you, in some cases it is, especially when we're talking about non-privileged people. Literally, the, you know, Salvation Army is it. And that's all 12-step based. So maybe encouraging people to, at least for a short period of time, to find ways to understand their traumatic experience. Like, they don't like being told what to do. Who does like that? But that's a biggie. That's a big trigger when you go to a 12-step meeting, because they're going to tell you what to do precisely. And if that triggers you, then you may need something else totally. Or you may need like a softer voice, even a friend who's been through the 12 steps and is informed about their own trauma, to talk you through that period. So I'm not sure if that's what you were looking for, but that's my answer.
It's really helpful. And I would add to that too, that, you know, one of the things with my PTSD, I have complex PTSD, is one of the big triggers is feeling trapped. And when I was in early recovery, I, especially because I went to AA, I was completely disempowered, because the philosophy is to hand over that power and to believe that you are powerless. And, you know, at that time, I didn't understand the nuance behind that. So here I am as a completely disempowered person, feeling really trapped in meetings, and not knowing that I was able to empower myself, that if I felt trapped in any way or triggered, that I was able to leave. And, you know, that's really important. Like you say, we're not, you know, we're not anti 12 step. It worked for both of us for a very long time. But we did choose to leave. And, you know, that door is not always closed to me. If I ever needed to go back, I would. But I really want to get across that it's important that people feel able to pick and choose what works for them, like you say, or to get up and leave, or to ask someone not to touch them.
And I think that takes transition, because when you're talking about privilege, which I totally am, you know, a really white girl from the Midwest, and that you know, especially when I turn blonde, and I'm totally not joking, that gave me a lot of privilege. Yeah. But since I work, and I have worked with people who are not privileged, identifying accessibility is really important. And especially when we're talking about the downside of 12-step facilitation groups, is that if we can, it is by far the most accessible means of recovery out there. And it's super imperfect, especially because you have so much rigidity in how people perceive the best way to work the 12 steps are. So understanding the transition, if you will, between saying I have a problem and I need help, and then deciding to not go to AA because of all the stuff you've heard about it, that transition, that middle period, can come from calling somebody like me, who, by the way, by ethical, I am required ethically to talk to somebody without charging them initially. That's just the dealio. Some people actually do charge, but I get calls all the time from people who cannot afford my services because I don't take insurance. That's my way of giving back to people who I can't treat because I have to earn a living this way.
Yeah.
And I'll spend up to an hour on the phone with somebody trying to talk them into the first steps of either getting to a meeting or taking advantage of some of the programs that I know are free of charge or very low charge in my area. Mm-hmm. And I think if we could embrace that, along with the idea of understanding that AA is not going to be for everybody, that being that we refer. We have the knowledge, most of us who are in recovery, to start looking at the broader scope of things. And again, that's part of the reason I love you guys, is because you're not just saying this is shitty. Sorry, I swore. I don't know if
and
you
I
guys
love
get
that,
that
about
right.
you too, that you're offering people that free consultation. And for the listeners too, we have had an episode on the landscape of recovery and different pathways, so we can link to that in the show notes.
It's so important. Accessibility is a challenge. It's a challenge for people who you wouldn't think it's a challenge for. I get folks all the time wanting a reduced rate, and I have group therapy for that. That's my reduced rate kind of thing. And then I also have my online stuff. But it's a challenge to spend money on your mental health, even if you have it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know?
I think, you know, it's an important discussion, and I love that you framed it with knowing your own triggers and, you know, recognizing that some things may be a better fit for you than others, and and honoring that. I think that's really important, to honor it. And like you said, whether it's honoring it in that you, you know, be brave and move chairs when someone's making you uncomfortable, you put yourself first, make yourself, you know, in your mental health a priority in that moment, or whether it's honoring yourself by finding meetings that do work for you or finding another program, if you have the means, choosing to invest financially in a program that you do enjoy, or that does feel, not that you enjoy, but that feels like the right fit. Like you said, that meeting that you talked about that, you know, people were like, don't go there. But for you, you wanted to be challenged. That's what felt right to you. And and so I think that's really the important piece here, is recognizing that, you know, it takes a little bit of self-discovery, and then it takes honoring your needs and whatever that looks like.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest challenge that we have. In all of the problems that I see that are brought to me as a counselor, is this idea of, you know, I guess it's called operating outside the box, but we tend to operate in our own cages. Mm. And, you know, I think back to the first time I had somebody, and this is when I was in treatment myself, and there were people who could not sit in a closed room. That's how traumatized they were. Mm-hmm. So they not only had to sit by the door, but they had to have the door open. Mm. And this happened a number of times, and somebody in the group got mad because she wanted the door closed. She was afraid of people hearing them, and the person walked out. They couldn't even say that they needed the door closed. Yeah. So I get that. I've seen that in action. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a kind of a mouthy girl, so I would say I need the door. You know, even in my worst places, I was always a little mouthy, as I call it. But for people who can't, I work with them. I see you. If you're out there, you can't visualize or think of yourself advocating in that way for yourself. Just know that you can find partners who will help you do that. Mm. And they don't have to be professionals. They can be somebody in a group online. Like, how then do I go to a meeting if I am afraid to be in a closed room, especially with men? And there are ways to work around that. It's all about accessibility and what's available in your town. But that first step of asking somebody to help you, and then those of us who are out there in the recovery arena with some recovery under our belt, to get awareness about, become curious, more curious. If you're in recovery, I think you have to be curious about life and be a lifelong learner. And that's how we help other people, by knowing the options.
Awesome. You know? I love that. Asking for help, getting curious, speaking up for yourself. Yeah, beautiful.
Well, or asking somebody to help you.
Yeah, absolutely. Asking for help. That's a challenging one. Even, you know, I think sometimes for people who have been in recovery for long term, it can be really challenging to ask for help, especially because you start to get the, you know, look good, so to speak. But we do have to start wrapping it up. I would love to hear, Lynn, any last thoughts, anything you want our listeners to hear if they are grappling with, being in recovery and working on any childhood, neglect or childhood trauma, or even adult trauma, but if they're trying to work through these things.
Yeah, I think, the thing that I'm landing on lately to say is that I firmly believe that everyone has within them the knowledge, the insight about themselves to solve their own problems. And what we tend to listen to is that loudest voice in our head, and we think that is us. It is not. It is your inner critic. I call her Nellie. She's nasty. She is not me. We've talked about this. She is not me. And that was, what an eye-opener, that this loud voice in my head was just telling me, oh, Pippi, and to not listen to her. Listen to that quietest voice that you can barely hear. That is your intuition. And that is the person that you are deep inside, the one that says, I need help. Hmm. And by that, I don't mean you're on the floor drunk like I was. Mm-hmm. I actually was in my bed. But you're more just at your wit's end about what to do next. That's the voice that I encourage you to listen to and reach out. That's all.
Thank you.
Beautiful. You're welcome. Yeah.
All right. Well, how can our listeners find you?
SoberSoulRecovery.net or the Sober Soul Recovery podcast on iTunes, or it's everywhere. It's even on places that I don't know. Every now and then I get an email. I'm like, oh, that's nice.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Lynn.
Yeah.
All right.
You both.
All right. Take care.
Mwah. Bye.
Mwah. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Breaking Free Podcast, Your Recovery, Your Way.
We want to hear from you.
Email us at hello@breakingfreerecovery.com or join our Facebook group, Breaking Free Community.
Tell us what Breaking Free means to you.